Welcome to the Ion Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. Matt Moore, as Tara Reed retweeted from Jack Napier, shout out to Paul Abdul, Chris Tucker, Snoop Dogg, Tara Reed, and Jay Leno for helping Arsenio Hall set it off. Welcome back. Back is beautiful.
That's a barrage of imagery.
It's a lot of people.
That's just a barrage of things to try and fit into my head all at once. That's too much, honestly.
It's kind of crazy to think about, like, just how transcendent that Arsenio Hall talk show was. Not just from, like, because it was really good and it had like a pretty big influence on the culture at the time, but just from a business standpoint, how he just made a ton of money basically off of, you know, the way he syndicated the deal and had it like spread out. Like, that's how he made just all of this unbelievable FU money that he, yeah. I mean, he'll never have to do anything again, but he's choosing to do stuff again. But it was kind of like, just from a stylistic kind of cultural impact, it was brilliant. And then from a business standpoint, my God, how do we do that with the show?
I plug in sounds, people going woof, woof, woof.
Oh, I can do that.
I have that power. I have that ability. I find the whole late night thing to be really interesting. I've been fascinated. I was fascinated by the Leno Letterman thing.
Yeah.
I think that this new era is really exciting with Jimmy Kimmel and Jimmy Fallon. Not that I ever watched those, because all I watch is Letterman, obviously.
I watch Letterman and Craig Ferguson. Craig Ferguson's on, right?
Craig Ferguson is legitimately awesome, though. He's pretty amazing.
I was technically in a skit on the Craig Kilborn show back when it was the Craig Kilborn show.
Really?
I was in the audience. I went to LA to visit friends, and we got tickets to the taping of the Craig Kilborn show, and in the audience, I was next to a planted guy, an actor in the audience who was heckling Craig Kilborn or something like that. And at one point, like, he like looks over at me and like pats me on the shoulder, like, can you believe this guy? It was probably my finest moment, my biggest accomplishment in my career.
Okay, listeners, get on YouTube, figure out, find some way. We're gonna need video of this. Gonna need a video of this, and a GIF is what we're gonna need. I'm gonna expect it by publication of tomorrow's podcast. So
God,
get
was,
on it right now.
Yeah, this was like, I don't know, 2002.
Oh, he's giving you the year too. He's making this too easy.
It was somewhere between 2001 and 2003, I think. Yeah, 2001, 2003. Sometime in that whole time for me is a bit of a blur.
There are legitimately going to be like 15 people that we'll try and find. We're gonna get tweets saying, "Do you remember what month it was? Can you tell me more clues? What shirt were you wearing?"
Oh God, I can't even imagine what my wardrobe was at the time. I was not a stylish person.
No, but today's post that you wrote was very stylish.
Hello, look at that.
Hello, bazinga. So you wrote a lengthy post on CBSSports.com discussing, I said volume. I don't even know if that term's accurate, but
it kind of is the volume of it, yeah.
The increase in frequency of three-point attempts in the NBA over the last 30 years, focusing on the last 20.
Right.
It's great stuff.
Thank you.
Works in a comparison with Malcolm Gladwell that talks about the cavalry versus the infantry versus what are referred to as the slingers. It would be the archers, but they're described as slingers. And we have an amazing Photoshop we dreamed up.
Yep.
and all this kind of stuff.
An incredible chart you put together.
And I don't know. It took way too long, by the way. Like, there's like five news posts. I was like, no, I'm so close though. The worst part was I added in all of the images for the individual logos on that chart.
Yeah.
And then was like, I don't like this. And I always go for the black chart with white lettering. I just always think that looks cooler because I'm 12.
Yeah.
Basically try and make my charts look like Trapper Keepers. But the problem was when I flipped it, all of the logos that I'd inserted went away.
Oh no.
And so I could have just pressed control, like my finger was on the control Z to press it, and I could have just gone back to the other one. I was like, nope, I really like the way this is going to look better. So I went ahead and flipped it and then kept it and redid everything.
Oh, jeez.
Just to get – that's why I was really hopeful that you were going to be like, oh, yeah, that looks great. Because if you'd said, it looks okay, but could you make it white? I was just going to throw my head through the window. Anyway, so it's really good. I guess my question is, let's try to take it forward, okay?
Okay.
You kind of mentioned this in the piece that it's problematic because the only way to really defend against this is to play extremely physical perimeter defense.
Yes.
And then that has – are you saying that there's a repercussion to that or just that it's extremely difficult?
Well, it's difficult because of the rules for sure. You know, no hand checking, very little contact is typically allowed. I mean, it varies from time to time, but it typically you're not allowed to make contact with the ball handler, right?
Yeah,
and that's just that wasn't the case, you know, before they took away hand checking, and because of that, it is so easy for a guy to either blow by a player in isolation or to get around a pick and roll defense. Like there are obviously really good pick and roll defenses that hedge and push the ball handler even farther from the basket and kind of stall things, but mostly like you get a lot of action on pick and roll because it's just so hard to defend, and when that happens. Because you can't be physical and kind of knock the guy off balance as he tries to make his initial move, it, you know, the defense then has to collapse and you're rotating, you're recovering and chasing. And you know, you talked about this last season with George Karl's philosophy. Most coaches who aren't Doug Collins want either, you know, three-point shots in the corner or shots at the rim because those are just the most efficient shots, especially when you factor in the extra point for the three-point shot. And so I just think that unless they allow a more physical brand of basketball, maybe not even hand-checking, but like some kind of chest bumping or something, I don't really know how they would do it. You know, I just don't see how you can kind of stop that initial point of attack that kind of sets off this chain reaction. And really, like, with the way the game looks now, how kind of like beautiful the flow of most games can be, especially against the really good teams at finding those shooters, like we saw with the Heat and the Spurs, I don't really know why the league would do that to kind of cut down on threes. I mean, three pointers are essentially exciting. It's what every March we have a couple of teams in the NCAA tournament, which is beautifully broadcast on CBS and broadcasting partners, other channels. We have a couple of those teams that get hot and it changes the entire complexion of the tournament. And so it's just like, it's such an exciting part of the game that in the league is studying, you know, David Sturgeon came out and said like in their meeting with the Board of Governors, like they were studying the effects of the 3-point shot and the kind of the growth and the importance of it. And I actually, you know, I wonder if that means that they're a fan of it, they're not a fan of it, how that's going to be looked at going forward. But, it just seems like this is where the league's headed.
I think they want to – it's like almost anything with the league where they want that healthy medium.
Right.
I think they want scores in – and this is per game, which we talk about as being as a poor thing, but it doesn't matter because it's how it looks and feels to somebody watching. They want scores between 95 and 120.
Right.
What they don't want is for the scores to then fluctuate and have it be from 115 – to 145. They don't want to have a league where, and that's why like the Rockets and Warriors would be problematic if they were to dominate, because then you've got this thing where it's just people absolutely launching. Your piece made me think something else, which is it used to be, and it has been for so long, the most dangerous player on the floor is somebody who could either, it went from somebody who could score effectively in the post in the 90s to somebody who could drive and get to the rim in the 2000s. Are we looking at a future where the most dangerous player is somebody who can hit threes off the dribble? Because realistically, there weren't shooters that could ever do that effectively enough to where it really concerned you. Like, well, he can, but nobody can really shoot that well.
Right.
James Harden and Steph Curry are guys that can.
Yeah, and that
Kevin Durant's another one.
And that's where I think like maybe the league is headed, just in terms of developing players coming into the league. I mean, being able to do what Steph Curry did in the first round, I mean, he was even, you know, he was okay in the second round, but that first round, like, just think about how much buzz that generated within the NBA community when that was happening. And as much as you want to see guys get dunked on, you want to see these crazy crossovers and breaking down the defense, there's something kind of just invigorating about a guy pulling up from 30 feet against a defender and just knocking down a three and getting the momentum going that way. And so I do kind of think, like, being able to attack with the three-point shot off the dribble, especially when you have guys coming up like James Harden and Steph Curry, that just looks like that's going to be kind of the new star.
Well, I think there's a filter down too, right? Where those guys are the superstars, and then think about what the traditional role player was. It was guys that could give hard fouls and rebound, right?
Right.
The new model for what the effective role player is the 3-and-D.
Yeah.
It's a guy that you can pass to in the corner and rely on him to hit an open three-pointer in the corner, and who plays effective defense. Kawhi Leonard is like the best, not the best, is one of the best role players in the NBA, and that's why he's like bordering on star, because he's so good at role player things, you want to believe that he's a star. And so that's kind of like an interesting kind of, I think, wrinkle as well, that the threes and D's guy, Chandler Parsons, I think, is another one. I think Parsons has got a lot of upside defensively for him to improve on.
Yeah.
He's going to be a huge part of this Rockets team.
He's going to be
a massive part of this Rockets team. And it's related to his ability to get out and space the floor and catch and shoot. So those kind of guys are doing that. Now, we have to factor in that there's going to be also an evolution of, within the next 10 years, the types of players coming in are going to change too. We could have an influx of 7-footers again,
yeah,
that are talented.
Absolutely.
That could shift this again. And if you're able to effectively – I mean, if you're able to just hammer guys inside, it does cause that defense to adjust. And when you force defenses to adjust, that adjusts the personnel you put on the floor.
Yes.
And that can cost you shooters. I think that's where like the shift may come. But it's going to depend on whether or not the league is going to see this as a good thing or a bad thing, and whether or not they're willing to let that evolution come naturally or go the other direction. It's funny too, because talking about this reminds me, I was hyper skeptical of Chip Kelly's offense coming into the NFL.
Yeah.
And then last night, it was just amazing to watch that thing go. Now, that was one game, and I told Will Brinson of our NFL team, I was like, I want to see what happens in week 8 once these guys get a book on how to defend.
Yes.
And I'm also really concerned because I really think Michael Vick's going to die. but in the NBA, you don't have that concern, right? So, and really, Chip Kelly's offense is slightly derivative of 7 seconds or less, which is also derivative of the run and shoot. Like, all these things play off each other in terms of guys stealing concepts, but the wide open offensive concept has been hyper popularized in the last 10 years.
Because that, I mean, you think about it, like in any sport, you know, people want defense in the NFL. They want big hits, although maybe now that, you know, the way the concussion issue is gone, big hits won't be quite as fetishized as they have been. in the past, but I would say that, you know, a shootout of 35-28 in the NFL has always been a lot of fun. I mean, you think about Frank Reich bringing back the Bills from 35 down. You know, like, you have a high-scoring game that gets a lot of fans into it. There's a lot of back and forth. It's a lot of fun. And in baseball, you know, helped by the steroid era, you know, seeing massive home runs and a lot of runs scored because of all these three-run homers was a big thing. And in the NBA, you know, we had such a bogged down defensive physical brand of basketball that kind of lost fans once Michael Jordan was gone, and now it's gotten more popular. One, it helps that we have the stars to back it up with Kobe Bryant and LeBron James and Kevin Durant, Carmelo Anthony, all these guys, you know, over this last decade. But also the ability to just put the ball in the basket. Like, no one wants to see an 81-78 game. The 2005 finals were great. I thought, from, you know, I really enjoyed the Pistons and Spurs going 7 games, but are you going to want to watch that slugfest, or are you going to want to watch the Spurs and the Heat now, you know, going 7 games, trading these incredible offensive possessions?
I think the ideal has always been great defense and superior offense, like just,
yeah,
like offense that had to go against really great defense and just was able to get there. And that's really why, honestly, these finals were so incredible, because that's what it felt like. I don't think we want to go back to the 70s era of, like, we don't want to have these kind of matchups where I like every now and again getting a Rockets Warriors game and having it be 140-130. I think that's fantastic. Like, that's amazing. Or like 135-120 in overtime. I don't want us to get to a point where 115 is our average. It needs to be still, I think, between 95 and 105. That's where I think the best feel of games come from, because there is a point where, and this may be a point that you and I disagree on, I think there is a point where I don't want to just see guys jacking up shots and nailing everything. It just, to me, that becomes rote. It becomes boring to where they have to feel special in that there's at least a good chance or a decent chance they're not going to go in, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think we'll ever get there just because I think defenses are always going to – people are always going to find ways to defend them. I mean, that's the thing is
– especially with the athletes we have.
I mean, Harden and Curry had fantastic years last year, but we've seen this – I think – and Wade, I think, is a really great example of it gets harder and harder because they find new ways and new things that bug you,
right,
to run at you. Talking to defenders this year, that was one of the things that was really insightful to me, talking to Shane Battier and Iguodala and a few of the other perimeter guys that I was talking to. It's not, oh, there's a book on the guy and then they figure him out. It's no. They learn a couple things that work, and then the player makes adjustments, and they learn a couple more ways to bother them and some ways to counter for the adjustments, and then that player makes even more adjustments. And that's one of the reasons that Kobe has always been so effective, because Kobe Bryant was able to basically, and LeBron is the same way too, the elite players in this league, there is no adjustment.
Right. They make it or they miss it.
Yeah, you can guard Kobe as much. Now, there are things that you can do to irritate the crap out of Kobe and bother him and make it more difficult. But I think that attrition, that war, that tug of war between the two is what makes the NBA really great.
I think what you're saying is the next wave of defense is simply psychological warfare.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Which, why not? Why wouldn't it be?
I will tell you this. I think we've started to see it, and nobody's really commented on it. We're going to see a lot more full court press one-on-one, not multiple guys.
Not setting up a trap, yeah, but more guys like Eric Bledsoe, Avery Bradley, Lindsey Hunter back in the day, like guys that can pick up full court, not get totally burned, and just harass.
Dogging them to get down and making them spend more energy just to get the ball up the court. And I think you're going to see I think the Chris Paul rules, which were kind of – nobody's really – I don't think anybody's talked about this enough, because Paul's never been at a Western Conference Finals level. There is a pattern, if you look back, that the way to attack Paul is you legitimately throw two defenders on him the minute he crosses half court.
Yeah.
That is – they've done this consistently to Paul. The Nuggets have done it. The Mavericks have done it. The Grizzlies did it last year. This is the most effective way to guard him. I think you're going to see a lot of that start to happen with Curry. Harden is a little bit trickier, because Harden is one of those where he wants you to press because then he's running.
Right.
He wants to go full speed at the basket. Steph Curry doesn't want to go to the basket.
No, Steph Curry is terrible at the basket.
Steph Curry wants you stand back so he can pull up the perimeter. And,
right.
And, like, that's the thing. And it's really crazy because, you know, for years we've mocked the Puget 3, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's a horrible shot. I'm terrified of a Steph Curry Puget 3 if I'm the defense. That's the one thing I'm like horrified about.
Because not only does he take it, but he hits 45% of his threes, where he takes them, you know, maybe the most in the league. And so when you're taking, you know, 7, 8, 9 threes a game and hitting 45% of them, why wouldn't you be terrified of that?
So I think that's going to be one of the really amazing things about next season. Everyone's really excited for what Curry's going to do. I'm really excited also for how our defense is going to adjust. Like, what are teams going to start doing to counter for this new model, which is – and, like, there's a lot of coaches that just simply won't adjust to it because they don't like it. Like, it's almost like if I ignore it, it'll go away.
Right. Which is always a great strategy.
Yeah. Like, oh, you're like, I don't like this wide open just throwing up three stuff, so we're going to guard you like you have before. Okay, but you're going to get buried if they shoot you decently. And there's going to be a lot of teams that are going to say – I really think this is maybe the next evolution of Carl, which is to say, we're going to focus on shooting the three, and we're also going to focus extremely hard on defending it.
Yeah.
I think especially the Rockets might be one of the first teams to do this, to say, you know what? We got Dwight Howard. If you get bias, you get bias. You can deal with Dwight.
Right.
But we're going to focus on shutting down your three-point attempts. And if all you're doing is taking pull-up dribbles from 18 feet, we'll live with it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's you know, you actually mentioned the post adjustment of maybe we'll get an influx of 7-footers, and I can't remember if I wrote this or maybe I just thought about it during the Eastern Conference Finals, but the times I found that Roy Hibbert was most successful, and part of it was he's just a massive human being with a huge size advantage against Chris Bosh playing center, or even Chris Anderson playing center. Really any Chris. He can just dominate. But with him, I noticed the best way for him to attack was to attack quickly in the post, And the more you think about it, like with the way defensive rules are set up, the way, I mean, obviously the centers were better 20 years ago, but the defensive rules were also made it really easy. They were just going one-on-one. And so their one-on-one skill just won out most of the time. Because it was so, you couldn't cheat over that well. I mean, if you were going to double, you had to commit, run. You're almost diving to the basket like a cutter, but you're diving as a defender to double, and then they could, you know, guys like Olajuwon or Shaq or David Robinson, they could pick you apart. But they always had time to operate, which made it, you know, almost easier because they had the time and the space. Now defenses can cheat over and have help there as he catches the ball. And so maybe that next evolution for post play is simply attacking as soon as you get it. You know what you're going to do, and having centers who are fine-tuned to be able to go right into their hook shot when they have position, and not just, you know, not taking these unnecessary dribbles and this unnecessary time in the post that allows the defense to take away whatever move they want to make.
I absolutely agree. I think it's a great point, because if you look at the really great post players in the league right now, Duncan, I think, is an exception, because Duncan is so strong, so big,
right,
and so good that he can hold, and he's basically daring you. He's we saw it in the playoffs. I saw it up close and personal. Duncan would get the ball and hold it, and the defender's like, "Ooh, I should go double." And Duncan's like, "Please do."
Yeah, but Duncan's just like, "Come on, I dare you. Play right into our hands here."
Yeah, come on down. No, don't worry about Danny Green in the corner. Yeah. He's just Danny Green. Come on down.
This guy got cut by the Cavs. You'll be fine. Yeah.
Here, I'm holding the ball right out in front of you. It's right here. But like Al Jefferson, he gets the ball and he goes almost immediately.
Yeah.
And he struggles when he doesn't. Hibbert's the same way. One of my things about Marc Gasol, that's one of my favorite things, is the guy gets the ball and is immediately like, "Nope, I know exactly what I'm doing." Yeah. Like, I'm either going to the face up, I'm going to take the jumper, or I'm going to the hook. Like every single time, I'm going to the same moves. And those guys, it's really important, because you just simply cannot give them time.
Yeah.
To collapse down, you got to force them, and it also helps too, because if you're doing that consistently, they know they don't have time, so they're more likely to overcommit, and then that opens up your perimeter guys.
You know who doesn't have much time left on his contract? LeBron James.
Smooth transition.
Oh yeah.
So we'll do this real quick because we got to get to the Warriors today. But I did want to comment. Chris Broussard has a piece up on ESPN where he spoke with LeBron James in the first of what will be much of this, and I kind of wanted to set kind of a primer. We'll probably have to do this again at the start of the season, but I did want to kind of, I guess, maybe talk it out with you about what our approach should be with some of this stuff.
I figure just treat it like some coaches will treat three-point shooting. Let's just ignore it and hope it goes away.
Because there's going to be a lot of backlash from you, the readers and listeners right now. You're going to get really irritated. Some of you are going to get really irritated with the coverage this year.
Some writers will too.
Yeah, not just us, and that's gonna be the bit. Well, I'll get to that in a second.
Yeah,
and there's gonna be a lot of blowback because there's gonna be so much coverage of what LeBron is gonna do.
Yep.
Going into 2014, when he has an opt out and could conceivably sign with another team in free agency, and it's gonna become very popular to also exploit that, which is to say, we shouldn't be talking about this. Here's my column on how ridiculous this is and right. How stupid the media is.
Right.
I want to assure you right now, if these things did not generate interest, and it's not just page views, it's mentions, it's conversation on television, on radio, at your work with people, LeBron James conceivably going to another team is a story that almost transcends sports. It did the last time.
Yep.
And that's a lot of this. There's a part of at least from my perspective, I can't just say, well, we really shouldn't worry about it, because I say to myself, look what happened last time. There was a huge amount of – I talked to people throughout that year that were not in the know, but people that I respect and trust and are in the know, that know people in the know rather, and there was a very strong feeling of he's not leaving Cleveland. I mean, this is all really moot because there's no way that he does this. It would be inconceivable. And that word does not mean what they think it means.
Right.
So there's going to be this conversation, and it's not that we have to talk about it. It's that we should talk about it. This is the most powerful player in the world in a modern era where player movement is higher than ever, who has already shown a pattern of being willing to go somewhere else and doesn't have that strong emotional tie to want to continue his career somewhere else. LeBron's going to be LeBron no matter where he goes. And I think that's one of the transcendent things about him, is that he's going to have this massive legacy despite having played for multiple teams. You can argue that that's going to impact how he's considered in a historical context, and I think that there's room to talk about that. But it doesn't change the fact that even being able to do this and still be in that conversation shows you how great he is.
Well, and, right? You know, oh, absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, in 2010 it was, you know, this guy, there were still quite a few people, even in the media, who were like, I don't know if this guy's the best player in the league. I don't know what he does. You know, I don't know if he gets you a championship. Is he worth the trouble? Blah, blah, blah. And it was still, you know, this media circus. Now we know he's worth the trouble.
Yeah.
Like, LeBron is absolutely worth the trouble. He's absolutely the best player in the league. Wherever he goes, he's not just going to pick, like, the Bobcats and try to win them a championship. He's going to go somewhere where he has a great shot to win the championship because of the supporting cast, if he goes somewhere other than Miami. And so you know that he is not only possibly leaving a place or staying in Miami, you know that he is taking arguably the best title shot in the league to another destination or keeping it where he is. And I think that's just going to make everything even crazier. It's like, where do you want the next NBA champion to be? Because that's where, you know, you can make a great case that wherever he goes, if he goes anywhere, that's where the next title is.
I mean, imagine if Jordan had been a free agent in 93 and he hadn't retired.
Right. Well, that was even the thing, I think, when he was going on those one-year deals. I remember watching SportsCenter at the time, and they had photoshopped, like, a Knicks jersey onto Jordan. You know, there was talk, like, would he go to the Knicks? Would he go here? Would he go there? Like, it wasn't the same level of hysteria because just the media was different at that time. But can you imagine if we had that media cover, or the media coverage we have now, back when Jordan was on these one-year, $30 million deals?
Yeah, I mean, it would be unfathomable. It would just be absolutely ridiculous with the level of attention that he garnered. I think I'm going to be writing this up later today for CBSSports.com, talking about James is essentially following the same model he did in 2010, which right. It's what made the decision so surprising. It was such a miscalculation.
Yeah.
Of so many people in his crew who had, and he'd been so careful, because that year with the Cavaliers, he was like, nope, like, I'm focused on staying. I love this team. I love this city. I'm focused on this year. I want to win a title. We need to win a title this year. This is on me. Like, the conversation was going to be there, just like it's going to be there with Carmelo, just like it's going to be there with Kobe, just like it was with Dwight Howard last year. Because that's a reporter's job, is to basically be like, look, you still haven't answered this question. And they don't have they have the choice to not answer it. But the best way for them to deal with it is to do what James did in 2010 and what he's starting to do now, which is just say the same line over and over again. I love this team. I want to compete for a title. I'm focused on this year. It's not fair to my teammates. Yada, yada, yada.
He's essentially Kush and Jerry Maguire, just the same line of, I'll either surf or ski. When there was talk of the number one pick in the NFL draft either going to Denver or San Diego, and Jerry Maguire is trying to get that deal. That's LeBron's surf or ski, is just, I want to focus on this year, and we'll see what happens in the summer.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also interesting because – and you can say, well, if he's not saying anything, then why are you guys talking about it? And the answer is because LeBron can end this whenever he wants.
Yeah.
LeBron James can say, I'm not going to opt out of my contract. Or he can say, I'm going to opt out, but we're going to get a deal done. Like, Dwayne Wade's already said, I'm coming back. He's basically said, if I have to take a pay cut, I have to take a pay cut. We'll see what that amounts to. But Wade's not going to get the same kind of attention that James is this year. Not only because he's not as much of not as good of a player, but because Wade has made it very obvious, I'm going to retire with the Miami Heat. This is what's going to happen. James isn't doing that purposefully. Like, James has the, and even if, you know, he could, it's not good to go back on it, but I would actually might argue that it might be better for everyone involved. He'd just be like, no, yeah, I plan on re-signing with the Heat. And then it would kind of be like, well, he already said it, he planned on it. We can't really talk about it because that's what he said he planned on. And until he says something different, we'll have to change it. And then he could change his mind.
Yeah, it was like, well, the plan changed. The plan changed. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah. But I just think it's – I guess I wanted to kind of prepare the listeners. This is going to be a story, and I encourage you to take note of this story in sports, because if you're listening to this podcast, you love sports. This is a huge story. And no, it's not on-court stuff, but it affects on-court stuff. And it is a – it's – and it's also – there's a part of me that's also like, I have no other way to tell you this. You're going to have to deal with it because this is how we pay our bills.
I think I'm pretty firmly on record of hating this kind of stuff. If anyone knows me, follows me on Twitter, has listened to the podcast where you and I discuss it with Dwight – this kind of stuff, just the constant update of the same thing, really annoys me. But I also recognize that while I may be annoyed with it, it is important. Like, it really is.
I think the key here is, if you want to demand something of the media, demand that we cover this stuff smarter and better.
Yes, absolutely.
Don't demand that we ignore it, because we can't.
Right.
Demand that we cover it in smart ways, innovative ways, and try and bring you something that's as close to what we can not guess, but estimate, analyze as the truth as possible.
Yes.
We're never going to be able to give you 100%, but if this is going to be a part of your life, at least demand that we try and make it as intelligent a discussion as possible.
Yeah, completely agree.
Anyway, so there's that. So let's talk about a team that you have a little bit of a thing for.
I like the Shooters. Shooters, and the Golden State Warriors last year were one of 9 teams in NBA history to shoot better than 40% from 3-point range in a season.
I looked at their numbers randomly and one day a couple weeks ago and was just like, how is this possible? Like, how did this team not win more games? They shot so well. I don't understand it.
Yeah, well, what's crazy is, like, I think we got this impression in the playoffs, because this is how they played, is that they just went around chucking threes all the time. And they didn't. Like, they were – I mean, they were still in the upper half of the league, but they were pretty low in terms of, like, 3-point attempts per game. They were
– Is that right?
I mean, they were I think they averaged, like, 19 a game or something like that during the regular season, 19 attempts a game, which is – I don't know. I think it was, like, 11th or 12th maybe.
So the question then is, should they shoot more?
I think with the addition of Andre Iguodala, they should, and not that he should be taking them necessarily, but I think you have, and this is going to sound like I'm just crapping on Jarrett Jack, which I am a little bit, but you're going to have a secondary ball handler with Iggy where he's a much more willing passer, and not that Jack isn't, but I think Iguodala just at this point understands the best way he can contribute to a team is being the best role player in the league rather than trying to be a star, right?
Yeah.
And I think having him come around on pick and rolls with, you know, Curry coming off a screen on the weak side, or Klay Thompson coming off a screen on the weak side, or, you know, Harrison Barnes spotting up in the corner, I just think that there's so much of a better chance to find the great shooters for threes with a more willing passer, that I do think they should shoot more. Even if their percentage goes down 2%, still a team shooting 38% for the year, taking a lot of threes, like, that's pretty good.
It's just going to bump up your plus rating. I mean,
right,
that's
exactly
all it's going
to
do.
Yeah, I honestly think they should. And, it leads to an interesting conversation that our friend Ethan Sherwood-Strauss has been all about, is, you know, should David Lee be a big part of their team? And now, I'm a backer of David Lee. I think he was fantastic last season. I think he got All-NBA third team, which I was fine with. Like, he was really good last year. But in the playoffs, I don't know. I like the look of them going small.
I like the look of them going small against Denver. I want him to be traded just because I want everyone to get off his back.
Yes, absolutely.
I just want him traded somewhere where the fans will be like, no, we got the defense. We're good. We're okay. We could use somebody that could actually, you know, score in the post worth a damn. That'd
right.
be nice.
Right.
I think there's a lot of places that would find him useful. I like David Lee's attitude. I think that I find the idea that he's this massive problem ridiculous, especially, like, there's this idea that David Lee is the worst defender on the planet. There's a bunch of really questionable defenders in the Warriors. There's a bunch of guys that play well in the playoffs, but overall I would go, I got some worries about that. We'll see how they do systemically in certain areas, but they got some concerns. Now, they've also got a lot of guys that I think are going to improve a lot and get better.
Yeah.
One thing with Iguodala, so he's like all NBA players, he's extremely prideful. So if you ask him, can you shoot? He's going to say, yes, I can shoot. Right. Everyone thinks I can't shoot, but they're wrong. I can shoot. If you ask him not to, he won't. That's right. The kind of the weird thing about him. It's like he will just like he will never tell you, oh, that's not my strength. He's going to say, I can do everything, because he's extremely prideful. But if they tell him, run the pick and roll and throw to the corner, cool. And, man, he's a guy that's been wanting a coach that he could really connect with for a long time, and he had a lot of problems in Philadelphia.
It's weird because Doug Collins is, you know, he's a player's coach.
Now he's a player's analyst. So, but I think that Iguodala, I think that Jackson is – he will do – Iguodala basically run through walls for Mark Jackson.
Absolutely.
What will probably happen. I think that probably a big part of their pitch was based off of Jackson's religion. I think that that's probably something that fits really well with what Andre thinks and how he feels, and that's going to make him feel really connected. He wants to have a team that's kind of spiritual, and they were a pretty religious team last year. I think that that's going to fit in with their model really well. He's a good fit from a personality, character, identity, basketball. He's a good fit on all of those levels. So it's there's really not a way that this isn't going to work out well for them, and it gives them it gives them a guy they can lock down and say, Steph, you can go take whoever the guy is in the corner and not have to worry about putting him or Klay Thompson on. And there's an interesting kind of parallel between the Nuggets and Warriors. Gallo was an exceptional defender last year because they were able to say, Danilo, all you need to do is go guard the secondary weapon on the perimeter, because Gallo was having before Iguodala was there, and now this year he would have to guard the primary perimeter weapon, and that's no longer going to that no longer had to be the case. Iguodala would take the one, and then Gallo would take that secondary weapon, and it only made the entire defense better. And you're going to see the same thing where Klay Thompson's a good defender. He'll be able to guard somebody who's not as much of a tough matchup. Well, Iguodala's able to focus in on that, and Curry's not going to have to guard guys like Derrick Rose, guys like Russell Westbrook, those kind of guys. He's going to have to guard Thabo Sefolosha and guys on the perimeter and focus on his offense. Giving offensive weapons like Curry soft offensive players to guard while letting them save their energy, that's going to be huge. God.
It's absolutely huge. And, you know, I was thinking about the teams that do go small against them, which it will happen throughout the year. When they can throw out a perimeter defense of you know, hiding Curry on the worst perimeter offensive option, and then you've got Iguodala, Klay Thompson, and Harrison Barnes swarming the perimeter. I mean, I'm not the only one that thinks this. A lot of people think it's like Harrison Barnes seems destined to be a really good defender in this league.
Yeah.
And working with Iguodala is, I think, it's just only going to boost that you know, trajectory even quicker. I think that, like, being able to do that with, you know, assuming Bogut can stay on the court and he's protecting the rim, good God. Like, that's going to be fun.
Yeah, they're going to be – I mean, I think that their ceiling is probably 58. I'm probably going to peg them for 57.
Yeah.
Like, it's rare that I put a team at its ceiling, but I really think this team is going to hit its ceiling. Now, I have reservations about their health.
Yeah, as you should.
Because I don't trust the human body at all. This is apparently what I've learned from talking on this podcast. Zero faith in the human body.
You're just waiting for everybody to become cyborgs.
Exactly. I'm just waiting for everyone to fall apart. Everyone becomes RoboCop. The bench got worse.
Yes.
And that's okay because their starters got better. But there's a weird kind of payoff, like question mark here, where you're saying they've had guys that have had trouble staying healthy, and so you want to get them as much rest as possible. Like, Steph had to take rest last year. Like, there were just times when he got banged up and needed a few days, and Bogut was out most of the year. But they've also impacted their bench. So now it's – theoretically, there's going to be a temptation for Jackson to play his starters longer, and that's going to be, I think, difficult because of the health concerns. But you also can't be like, well, let's give him some rest, because throwing out you know, Tony Douglas, who's going to be their backup too? Off the top of your head.
Probably Bazemore. Either Bazemore, or maybe they'll move Iguodala and then move Barnes into the small forward position.
Yeah. So I mean, you can cycle him out and keep Iguodala there, and then, you know, so like Douglas, Iguodala, Barnes. I'm trying to think who their four is going to be.
Maurice Spates.
Spates. And then center is a real big question mark because of Azeeley's injury.
Yeah, like, I mean, they did sign Jermaine O'Neal. Who knows how much he can actually give them?
Right. So that those are going to be, I think that's going to be a thing that's going to cause issues for them. Where I guess the best way to describe it is there are some teams like the Spurs that can have injuries and they're going to be fine. They can miss Tony Parker for a month and they're still going to win probably at a 60% clip.
Right.
The Warriors, if they have any smattering of injuries, even minor, they're going to have their level of difficulty goes way, way up on both ends of the floor.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the thing that helps them record-wise, where in, you know, you pegging them pretty much at their ceiling for them, is the fact that they play in the Pacific Division. I mean, they get four games against the Suns. That should be four wins. They get four games against the Kings. Kings playing a little tough, but that should still be four wins. And then four games against the Lakers. Like, can you imagine this Lakers team keeping up with that firepower if, you know, if they're healthy? You know, I'm not saying that's going to be four wins, but you know,
three ones, a reasonable expectation.
Yeah, that's 11 wins out of your division, and then you've got, you know, maybe you split with the Clippers or you win one against the Clippers, but that's a lot of wins coming from your division opponents.
I think the other thing is I do believe this. I think Mark Jackson, because of his playoff experience, is going to be way more willing. As good as Rorikl is, I think that the Jackson's going to be very willing to sit guys for most of April now that they've got some playoff experience.
Yeah.
It is crazy to me. I was thinking back about I remembered how nuts it was because it was going to be Rockets, Warriors, Jazz. It was locked.
Yeah.
Like the probabilities were extremely high, and so many things went wrong in the exact right order for different teams that you wind up walking away. But it worked out really great, I think, for the Rockets and Warriors. Even though the Rockets weren't lost in the first round, that Thunder series gave them a lot of confidence.
Yeah.
Even if Westbrook had stayed healthy and they finished a sweep, I still think the Rockets would have gone into the offseason being like, you know, we got something here, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do
you get concerned about Andre Iguodala's free throw percentage? It was really bad last year.
Yeah,
I mean, it was like 57%, and you know, the Nuggets have been near the bottom of the league for a few seasons now, and I wonder, is part of that like altitude / Carl system of go, and they're too tired for free throws? Like, what is that?
I think it's probably that confluence of factors. I think that you can probably say because it's been consistently bad in Denver, I think you can reasonably say playing at a fast pace in altitude, they do, and it's weird because they do better when they're in rhythm.
Right.
Like if you're going up and down and you get comfortable, that's when they ran teams out. But I think that there's also a cost of when you stop and you're like, it's the same thing as like you go running, right? And you run for a while and you're feeling good as long as you're doing it. And then I'll take my dog for a while and then come back and drop her off and then go again. Well, when I drop the dog off, when I stop myself and I break that rhythm, I'm like, ugh.
Right.
Ugh. Okay, I got to go again. Okay. Ugh. And so I think that there's a cost there. I think he had a wrist injury last year that he did not disclose. He had actually a torn wrist ligament. That I said, did you have a wrist injury? And he said, yeah, actually I tore a wrist ligament, a minor tear. It took a couple weeks to heal. That's why I was wearing the brace. But nobody announced it. Nobody asked. And I was like, okay. You know, and then, you know, it's not the Nuggets PR fault. I think that the Nuggets in general, the Nuggets PR actually, I think, is probably the way a lot of fans wish their team was. Because the Nuggets PR in general is kind of like, why would anyone care? Like you didn't ask, so why would we bother you with this? Like, it's no big deal. Right. So we're not going to make a huge deal out versus the Knicks who are like, nothing is wrong. And other teams were like, so and so has a minor quad injury. You know, da, da, da. That's what I prefer because I like knowing everything. But it was also funny because I was like, he didn't say, he's like, well, I've been in places before where they didn't, even if I was injured, they would just say I was soft. So I decided not to say anything. He's really bitter about his early career. Like,
yeah, you could. I think he's awfully bitter about it. That seems to come through.
Yeah. But the good news is that it also means like he plays through stuff and he's. He's really pretty tough when it comes to injuries. I will say this though, he's not a good shooter off the dribble. He's not a good 3-point shooter. He's not a good shooter. He's just not. He's great at getting to the rim and dunking, but that's really his only scoring threat. He can do some, there are times, now I will say this, he's oddly a guy that I trust a lot in the clutch. He's been really good in clutch situations. Like, he's able to hit, like, if you just need that one shot, especially I like him actually in catch and shoot situations with the clock running down from the outside. He shoots pretty well in those situations.
Yeah.
That's one area he can get in. But yeah, the real, until he shows that he can improve and get back up to a 79-80% shooter or get there ever, like, the book on Iguodala really should be you need to foul him.
To prove your point, in the clutch last year for Denver, he was 50.9% from the field, effective field goal of 56.4. That's not bad.
Yeah, no, he was...
That's pretty good.
That's why it drove me crazy when everyone was like, Gallo needs to have the ball at the end. And I was like, just run the pick and roll and get Iguodala at three. They're going to sag off of him because he can't shoot.
Right.
Like, this is... It makes me crazy because... I'm not saying teams should game plan these remarkably complex sets. I'm talking about stuff that teams will give you 80% of the time.
Right. And especially with situations like that, like we saw, and you know, I discussed this at length, or maybe ad nauseum, during the Nuggets-Warriors series, like, you keep giving NBA players open shots, they're bound to hit them.
Yeah.
And so you give it with all these open threes off of pick and rolls, like, yeah, he's probably going to hit those.
Yeah. Like, and that's – so they're going to be really great next year. I love Klay Thompson. I just think he's got a great attitude.
Yeah.
Is a fantastic player. He plays really well with Curry. I don't really get what everyone talks about with Harrison Barnes at the four. The results overall were good, but the individual results I was not a fan of.
Yeah, I think it's more of a team concept than necessarily what he does.
Yeah, it's like it looks really weird and awkward to me, but they end up outscoring their opponents by a lot.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's got to be a plus minus effect, right? Where there's got to be something going on here.
Right.
That's good.
Right.
Bogut, I think, is a huge question mark, and
as he should be. He's earned that distinction.
And that's what made I just could not believe last year where he wasn't even expected to play in that game in that opening series, and then all of a sudden he's there and he's dominating and he was so effective. He got ran down after, you know, only a couple of playoff games against the Spurs, but it's just I really have no idea what to expect. I just don't. I don't know, and it's not just from the perspective of whether he can play or not. I don't know what kind of player he's going to be, because he wasn't like super post move Andrew Bogut with the Warriors. He was just big beastly man blocking shots and hurting people.
Yeah, I think with him you're just hoping for he'll move the ball out of the post, which he's very good at passing out of the post. And you're hoping he crashes the offensive boards, he protects the rim, he gets dunks when he gets the ball inside or he gets an offensive rebound. Like, I think at this point, if that's all he gives you, that's a huge win for you. But is he going to be on the court enough to do that?
Another thing, the big kind of one of the things the Spurs exploited a lot against them was they discovered that when Bogut would come up in those pick and roll situations, they just started ignoring him.
Yeah,
the teams figured out that he can't really move on that ankle in the pick and roll anymore, and so he would get the ball, and even though he was moving, it was just awkward. Like, his dribble was awkward. He was throwing turnovers, bad shots off the back of the rim. It was pretty ugly. He's not a guy that you want moving in space. David Lee, however.
Hey, that guy can move.
Their screen set, though, are some of the best in the league. If you ask me who has the best screen system in the league, I'm going to say San Antonio and Golden State.
Yeah, I mean, that elevator play got, you know, kind of beaten to death on the blogosphere. It was like I think Ethan or maybe somebody else had it early on in, like, January. And then either Ethan or somebody else had, like, kind of a thing in February about it, and then it was just kind of dormant, and then it was like everyone discovered this play in April. It's like, no, we've heard about this. It's great. Like,
yeah.
Like, we know.
I mean, I did a piece on it because I wanted kind of the other side of it. I talked to Chad Iske about – he's with the Sixers now – about kind of what – like, how do you defend it? And they actually didn't run much of the elevator against Denver or San Antonio. But talking to both Iguodala, Brewer, and – Lawson told me the same thing in that playoff series, as they were getting their asses kicked, that one of the big problems was they were hitting them with angles on screens that they weren't used to.
Yeah.
It was stuff that they hadn't seen before. They were just like, we were really caught off guard by the angles on the screens, and we're missing communication because we're not used to those screens being there. So it was, I mean, Mark Jackson just blew me away about how many different levels he just stepped up his ability to coach in the playoffs. He was phenomenal. From he played the underdog card, he got under the other team's skins, he had different schematic differentiations.
He worked the refs. He worked the refs.
Like he gave an MVP coach performance in the playoffs. Yeah. It was really phenomenal. It sets a pretty high bar for him.
Sure.
To say that. That's one. I think that's one of the things that I worry about. Just because I tend to trust sustained success more than this instant development. So I'm kind of like, have they set a bar too high? But really, when you look at it, again, it's just a matter of health. Like, if Curry's healthy and Bogut's healthy, this team should win no less than 52 games.
Yeah, I agree with that.
No fewer.
Yeah, they won 47 last year. Adding Iguodala to that, they all have a year together. I mean, how much worse do you think they got just for, you know, they had Landry and Jarrett Jack coming off the bench last year, and they're replacing that essentially, let's just say it's an even swap with Tony Douglas and Maurice Spates. It's clearly worse, but how much worse is it?
I think it's pretty a lot worse because, yeah, you got to understand, doing baseline awards, Landry and Jack were consistently popping
up. I mean, Jack, I think, finished third in the voting, right? And deservedly so. Like, he was right there.
I get that everyone just wants Jack to just pass to Stephen Curry all the time, let Stephen Curry do everything, but it doesn't. He is human. Like, the kid, the kid's wiry, gets bumped really easily, and really gets bothered by players playing physical with him.
Well, and whenever
gonna be a huge thing this year.
Whenever he turns his ankle, it's always like, it's not because of physical play, it's just random. Yeah. Like, he just steps wrong, not even against a defender, and all
then
of a sudden his
mad.
Ankle rolls.
Like, right? The entire world's out to get, like, everyone. It's like, you shouldn't even, like, go. It's like, don't go near his feet. Like, people should be, like, backing up away from his feet. Like, it's odd.
I like the Douglas for Jack swap, just for the simple fact I like the defense it brings.
Yeah.
And not that Jack's a bad defender, but Douglas is just kind of, you know, what we talked about earlier. He's one of those guys that can hound you for 94 feet. And he showed a lot of improvement offensively last year. I'm not sure how much of that is actually going to sustain, you know, year to year. I'm skeptical of those 1 year boosts. But if he can sustain that, that's not a terrible thing. I've never been a Maurice Spates guy. He's got a good jumper from like 15, 16 feet. He puts up fairly decent per minute numbers, but there's something about it.
He's Looney Tunes.
I just got that horrible. If any of you have seen Noam Schiller's just god awful, horrendous Photoshop of Maurice Spates, where he puts him into it, there's something about Mary movie poster. That's what just popped in my head when I said there's something about him. But there's just something weird about his game where I just, like, I look at that drop off from Landry to him. I'm like, that's going to be that's where Harrison Barnes being an effective four, maybe that's the key. Or maybe Draymond Green learns how to hit a shot in the regular season and they can play him at the four. I'm not sold on Spates being a consistent guy that they can have a positive impact with.
And I think the idea is that when they get Azeeley back, they'll have Azeeley, they'll have Draymond Green, who is huge.
Yeah.
And shot like 79% the effective field goal percentage in the playoffs, which again is one of those things I'm never going to understand. Never going to understand what happened with Draymond Green in last year's playoffs. They've got, you know, they've got some guys in there to play with him. Although I think a big question with him is just going to be whether or not. So his one of the things that's been big, the people that have liked him, and I am one of them, is that his true rebounding percentage was always really high.
Yeah.
In limited minutes, he always had a pretty high effective true rebounding percentage. And like with Memphis, it was 19.3. He didn't play much, but that's a really high percentage. Last year, it was 16, which is good. He needs to get realistically up to, he needs to get that back up to 16, 17%. consistently with Golden State. That's what they need from him. That'll be the question, I think, is can Mark Jackson convince guys to sacrifice for literally a greater good? Because I think he's just going to tell them that God wants his team to win. And so that's going to be, I think, is a question. I just don't think Jermaine O'Neal can contribute anymore. When he played for the Suns, he was great, but man, there's a point where you're too old.
Yeah,
just,
I mean, if they decide, like, let's just say they have huge injury after huge injury after huge injury and decide to tank, he's really good at goaltending threes at the end of games.
It's true.
So maybe that's where he contributes. Maybe he's a kind of Day of the Dead resort for them.
It's funny because I was going to say, like, you know, if they just managed to not give up Brandon Rush, but then I was like, yeah, because what they need is another shooter. They've got like 9,000 guys that can shoot from
exactly.
The wing. They don't need Brandon Rush. It's fine. Landry, though, I think Landry's going to be really quietly maybe an issue.
I guess
we'll just kind of have to see what happens with their interior defense. We're going to have to see because that was, you know, they had a lot of problems, and you and I talked about it on the podcast. They had some real problems down low defensively, and it wasn't just David Lee.
Oh no, it was a schematic thing. It was the personnel they had out there. It was rough.
So we'll have to see if, you know, the upgrades that they made can do it. But their plan, I think you can also tell, is look, we're going to win enough games with our starters in order to make at least a 5 seed.
Right.
And then we feel good about winning on the road with our combination of players that can get hot and being able to dominate at home at Rorikl. We feel like we're going to be able to do some damage. I think that's going to be their objective, and it's going to be a great year for them. And they're going to be a lot of fun to watch. It's, you know, big year for Curry. Yeah. Last year was, you could say last year was a big year for him.
A big last year. He was the best 3-point shooter of all time last year.
Right. But I guess I would say more of, but that's kind of thing though, right? Is nobody really knew what to expect. Like, is Stephen Curry worth the money? Can Steph Curry stay healthy? Can Steph Curry be a guy on a team that wins? And now it's like, yeah, okay, he can. What's going to happen when teams are really like, okay, we got to beat the crap out of this guy because otherwise he's going to kill us?
Yeah.
That's going to be, I think, a big question mark and how that team responds, because that team loses its mind when things get physical. They get in a good way because they'll come right back at you.
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting, I think, to watch what happens and see how physical they get played.
It is unreal to me that his worst, and this is a guy that has taken a lot of 3-pointers in his career per game. His worst shooting season from 3-point range is 43.7%.
It's nuts.
That's ridiculous.
I mean, you look at the number and you just look at that 45.3% from three point range last year.
Shooting
8 a game.
Right. I mean, that's just, it's unreal.
Yeah,
and he's a 90% free throw shooter. Like the thing that kills him is that he just can't hit a layup, or he can't hit that floater inside. Yeah. I mean, my God, if he learned how to finish at the rim, you would have to take him out of video games because he would be unfair. He's unfair already.
There's gonna be, I will tell you, I bet there's gonna be a lot of fights this year with Golden State, because I think teams are gonna, when he drives or even on the perimeter, I think there's gonna be a lot of teams. It's not gonna be the intensity of what happened with Denver, but I think there's gonna be a lot of teams that there are a lot of defenders that take themselves, that their professional pride very seriously, and are not gonna want to see that happen. It's funny because the Warriors were the ones that started fouling the Rockets, right, to break up the
the 3-point record.
The 3-point record.
Yeah,
I think there's gonna be games where Curry's like supernova and strutting down the court, and I think there's going to be teams that are going to be like, no, let's let them know he needs to settle down a little bit, and how they respond to that I think will be interesting.
How do you foul a comet, though? That I'm not sure. Like I feel like you would burn yourself.
I think Robert Horry has probably some indication on how it's done. I think he could see a little bit of that. So only we'll see if Curry flies through the air like Steve Nash did.
Oh, the one thing I'm not looking forward to is we will get this. This conversation of dirty versus physical,
yeah.
When, in regards to how teams play them, that will be annoying to me.
I think we're gonna get a lot of Golden State fans with an expectation of being good is gonna be an adventure for you and I this year.
There are some very smart ones. There are some fans that really, really got full of themselves after that first round victory. And not saying you shouldn't be excited, you shouldn't celebrate it, but there was a certain level of pomposity.
It's gonna be
that was,
I want to say right now, they have one of the best fan bases in the NBA. They're educated. They're involved. They're engaged. Obviously, like, Roracle's an amazing experience, but it goes beyond that. Like, they're always – they make up a huge percentage. Like, their online communities are fantastic. There, you can have your personal preference between which of the major blogs you prefer, but they're all active.
Yeah.
And have their own styles, and at least are they're really engaged online fan bases that want to talk basketball and all that stuff. And it's a fantastic fan base, but with that comes a lot of guys on the top end of the annoying scale. And there's going to be a lot of – especially, man, that Pacific Division has got some jaw jutters, right?
Oh, my God. So like, much
I'm
so.
I'm terrified if the Kings get good.
That would be fun. Can you imagine DeMarcus Cousins on a winning team?
Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God.
That would be a lot of fun.
I mean, here's an example. Like, last night, a Lakers blog said, hey, I'm at the Dodgers game, and Iguodala's here. And somebody he retweeted a reply, which was, "Let him know we're going to beat him next year." Like, Lakers fans still think that they're going to take out the Warriors. I'm like, do you realize how much better they are than you at this point?
That's cute.
You know,
that's really sweet. Like, I don't know. I feel like that's adorable.
We mentioned this kind of yesterday. I want a Clippers Warriors series.
Oh,
I want
my
a two.
God.
I want a 2-3 Clippers Warriors.
If that happens. I have to be sent to that series. Well, actually, maybe I shouldn't be sent to that series because there are laws against, like, lewd public acts that would probably happen if I got to watch that in person.
This podcast has gone weird places fast. And we talked about RoboCop for, like, 15 minutes yesterday.
Yeah. This is weird. Oh my God. I so much agree.
I mean, it could be a 4-5 or it could be a 2-3. 4-5 maybe is more likely because you got Thunder and Spurs, but I don't know what team's going to – I can't see a team outside of – like, I'm almost positive the Clippers-Warriors is going to be the 3-seed. One of those guys is going to be the 3-seed.
Yeah, that's probably correct.
I mean, here's what's really weird. I mentioned this a while back. When I started doing off the top of my head thoughts about – because what I do is I make some notes in August, and then I make some more notes in September, and then towards the end of this month I'll really sit down and be like, all right, what do I think about this season? And – I think I literally said this to myself. Well, I think the Clippers are going to win the division, but I think the Warriors will win more games.
That
difficult. That's difficult to do.
Yeah, that seems like. I mean, I guess it's possible. Anything's possible.
So says Kevin Garnett.
Yeah.
I just think that I think the Warriors are going to be fantastic. I think a season long. Battle for the Pacific Division between Clippers and Warriors could be really entertaining.
We'll have some really fun ones this year in terms of, like, Rockets versus Spurs, even throw the, you know, Grizzlies up there, Clippers Warriors, Bulls Pacers, Heat Magic. Yeah, a lot of great races for the division
title.
Snuck
that one in, did you? I love it because, like, the Heat won their division on, like, March 1st last year.
Right. About one third of the way into that winning streak.
Their magic number was like one in the middle of March.
Right.
It was absurd. I think they did. They clinched in the last week of March. They're the number one seed.
So when I wrote this in late July, I gave the Warriors a B+ for their offseason. What do you say?
Yeah. I think you're right on target. I think you're absolutely perfect. I think that if they'd done a little bit better with the bench, it would have been an A. I think if they... The only way that they could have gotten an A+ was to land Dwight Howard. That's the level of guy that you need.
Right.
But we talked about this yesterday, right, where the Clippers made all these moves, and I felt like they were a B+. It wasn't perfect, but it didn't need to be because they were already so good.
Yeah.
You can argue that the Warriors had a better offseason than the Clippers. And
Yeah. I mean, I don't know which side of that I would fall on, but that's a really good point.
And so they didn't need to get much better because they've already got Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, David Lee, Andrew Bogut, Harrison Barnes, Draymond Green, who shoots 71% of them offseason. I gotta look it up again. Hold on.
I think it was like 50% in the postseason.
It feels like 70%.
But maybe that was because there was a big drop off against the Spurs.
Yeah, it was 51%. He was at, like, I think 69% versus the Nuggets.
Yeah.
But anyway, so they've got all those guys that can do that. So I think that they're going to be, they're going to be fantastic. The Warriors fans have always wanted a good team, and they finally got one.
Yeah. Are you excited about our Lakers discussion tomorrow?
I feel like we should do video because I want props.
You want to essentially have a carrot top set?
Yes. It's a hat. Or actually, I think Gallagher might be more appropriate.
Sure.
Thought you were going to be a title contender? Smashed. No, I actually do wish we had video because I kind of want to have like action figures to play out different scenarios.
Oh God.
Here's Jordan Farmar's Aquaman. Do, 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 do.
Oh God, he's back.
Oh, I'm so excited. We'll have to do it tomorrow. I'm so thrilled Jordan Farmar is back. I would just wish they were bringing back Vucevic. Vucevic on a D'Antoni team, would be great.
Real quick, your point about Draymond Green in the playoffs. Against the against the Nuggets, he had a 70.4 effective field goal percentage. Against the Spurs, 32.8.
Yep.
There you go.
I got nothing. I got no way to explain it. I will say that it's amazing to me that Draymond Green has so much confidence. He is
That was he came here for a pre-draft workout, and talking to him after the workout, I was like, my God, this guy should be a lottery pick with his confidence. That guy believes in himself, and he's—I mean, I think he's going to be a really good role player in this league. But that guy—it doesn't matter how many shots he makes or misses. That guy believes that he belongs.
Draymond Green have it all.
Oh, Draymond Green definitely have it all.
All right. Lakers tomorrow. Thanks,
Yeah,
Zach.
thanks, Matt.